Welcome to the Manuscript Academy podcast,
brought to you by
a writer
and an agent
who both believe that education is key.
The beauty is the people you meet along the way,
and that community makes all the difference.
Here at the Manuscript Academy, you can learn the skills, make the connections, and have access to experts all from home.
I'm Julie Kingsley.
And I'm Jessica Sinsheimer.
Put down your pens, pause your word counts, and enjoy.
Hello, everyone. We have special guest today, Melissa Wharton-Vogan. She is an editor at Epic for Kids, the leading digital reading platform for children, where she works on comics and new IP projects for readers 12 and under. And we met you when you were at FSG at Macmillan, right, Melissa?
You did back in, not so far back in the day.
Tell us about you. Tell us what you're looking for and what it means to be the lead digital reading platform for kids.
I know. I'm so curious. I was like, what is she doing? This is so cool.
It's been a crazy transition when I moved away from the traditional publishing world over to more tech, because it's strange on two levels. One, because my job is exactly the same in terms of the editorial like service that I provide. There's the little tweaks that you'd get sort of even just from imprint to imprint or house to house. Epic has its own systems and processes. But it's also crazy because it's totally different. So I started at Macmillan Publishers, one of the big five traditional publishing houses, through FSG Books for Young Readers, which is where I stayed for about almost 6 years. I started out as an assistant, moved up to an associate, acquired, co-acquired, developed series, had new projects. And eventually, I just kind of felt like I wanted a change. I had been lucky enough at FSG to work on a lot of different children's book projects, everything from board book to picture book up through young adult. And I was really loving the middle grade space a lot. And this position opened at Epic for Kids that was primarily comics focused. And I'd found myself really loving the exposure I got to comics at FSG. I got to work with people like Tilly Walden. I got to work with debut artists and creators developing their new comics. And, you know, of course, FSG Books for Young Readers shares a publisher with First Second, and they put out so much incredible stuff in the comic space. So it was a field that I was really gaining a lot of interest in. And when the role opened at Epic for Kids, I had the same reaction as Julie, where I was like, what does this mean? When you see Epic, everyone thinks you work in healthcare or in gaming. So I transitioned over to Epic for Kids as a story editor. And what we do at Epic, as a digital reading platform, we are essentially the Netflix for kids books. We're two prompts. So one side is a repository of third-party content. So books that we license and present from big five publishers or smaller indie publishers. So it's a whole catalog of published print books that exist in digital form. And the other arm of it is Epic Originals, which is where I sit. And we come up with original content. We are an imprint within the Epic library. And we publish primarily comic series, although we do have an upcoming foray into prose that is going to be so good. And so what's interesting about Epic for Kids, for sort of the purposes of what I'm looking for to Jessica's question, is that we actually don't acquire. We work exclusively on IP, intellectual property, which means that the ideas we come up with are in-house, and we will either do them ourselves, or very occasionally we will reach out to freelancers and pay a flat rate. So we're doing a lot less of that these days. A lot of our work is we have a really robust in-house team, but in the past, at least, and potentially in the future, were lots of options for freelancers to work with us. I held writers' rooms where we would do production. That was one of my favorite parts of my job. So yeah, it's a bit of a different position than I saw myself in maybe 6-7 years ago when I started in publishing, but I've been really, really grateful for the experience.
So I remember having a meeting with an editor at a rather successful imprint that does a lot of IP, gosh, 5, 7, maybe even 10 years ago. What is time? And she said every Monday, everyone had to come in with an idea. Is that how it works?
No, that would have thrown me into a panic. That is not how it typically works at Epic, but I will say the brainstorms were some of the most fun I've had in this job. My team is largely ex-publishing, ex-traditional publishing, with a few other folks sprinkled in. And we were really of the firm belief from the top all the way down that good ideas come from anywhere. So we had sort of scheduled brainstorming meetings that would happen a couple times a quarter. We also had standing weekly meetings to go over editorial work and books on deck, books we were considering bringing forward into production. And that's where a lot of good ideas would come out in both of those ways. But it's funny, I was very afraid of that when I started at Epic. I was afraid of that, like, okay, you have to come up with the good ideas. I was really hard on myself for a while that I didn't feel like the ideas person. I would go into a brainstorm, guns blazing, so excited, but I would always be kind of banging my head against a wall to come up with something that felt new and not something that was just like a ripoff of a book I'd read 2 weeks ago. And I will say it gave me so much respect for writers. I very much took for granted that there's a million ideas out there and writers are working on books all the time and books get published every day. And then someone says, okay, so you do it. And I'm like, nope, I can't do that. And that's where the synergy of the team really stepped in, because there was no expectation that the ideas should all come from me. I worked very closely with a number of colleagues, writers on staff, illustrators on staff, other editors on staff to come up with new directions for franchises. The writer's room was huge for that, starting from scratch, but within the parameters of an existing series and just pinballing ideas off of each other. It was never all on a single person to pitch the idea, which ultimately took the pressure off. And I had a boss tell me, my wonderful manager told me that, because I expressed this to her saying, I feel like I'm not coming up with any good ideas. Like my ideas aren't the ones getting like picked in the meeting. And she's like, okay, so that's not your role. Then your role is to have the ideas in stage two. You're not the one coming up with the idea in stage one. That's okay. There are people for that. What you're good at that other people don't have the skill set for is the stage two, when the idea exists and we need new ideas to make it better. And that brought me a lot of comfort in that there's more than one way to have a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's interesting that a lot of us in publishing are very good at editing anything. As long as you get something onto the page, it is infinitely better than a blank page.
1000%. It does not matter what it is. I actually love when someone brings me, and one of my authors would bring me like an outline or like a synopsis and be like, this is a total mess. And I'm not even sure if it's a good idea. And our running joke, I worked with this author quite a bit, is that I would read it and say, something is really good, but something is off. And I don't quite know what it is. So can you fix it? And she'd be like, you give me nothing. But you have to have that stage of, okay, we're both in the dark here. And once you have a few words and a few expressions of this is working, this is not, you might not know why and you might not have a solution, but it puts you in a direction. And no idea is really that bad of an idea.
I mean, I love all this stuff. So tell me the parameters. How are they different from traditional publishing?
In terms of when you say parameters, like in terms of how
like
we
word count or how it looks on the page, or is it a spatial issue? Like how does that work?
Question. So I'll speak working primarily from the comic space, which is where a lot of the time at Epic in the past, our freelancers would come in most handy. I have one of my books is right here. Our most popular series is Cat Ninja. It's as goofy as it sounds. And it is a serialized comic, ages probably 6 to 8. And so for something like Cat Ninja, I bring it up because it is so much less about the nitty gritty logistics to us of like word count and panels per page and whatever. And it's so much more, can you write in this tone? Can you emulate this humor in a way that we haven't done yet? There's 45 books in the Cat Ninja series currently. Well, 10 of them are still under development. Season 7 is still in development. But there's, you know, 30 books already on the market and on the Epic platform. So can you do something that we haven't already done? And kind of to the point of just get something down, you know, we do look for 6 panels maximum per page. We want you to have art notes. We can get into that because I do think that is like a separate side of the brain. We want you to have art notes. Script writing is dialogue, almost exclusive, some sound effects. Like we want you to have that sort of down. Right now, our parameters are at 10-page comics. One of the coolest things about working for a digital publisher is the access to data that we have. we can see how many clicks we get of a certain title. And we can see how far certain readers get in terms of like, okay, 60% of people got to page 7, but then quit. Why'd they quit?
Wow.
Did it get really boring? It's been so fascinating. So when I started, we were doing exclusively 24-page comics. And there was an editor who started at the same time as me. And she just kind of raised her hand in a meeting. And she was like, why do we only do 24-page comics? And the room went kind of quiet. And someone said, well, God, I don't know. Just the way we've always done it. I guess we don't have to do it that way. And sure enough, that led to sort of a study of some of our reader data. And we realized that a lot of our readers were dropping off around page 11 or 12 of 24-page comics. So we were like, well, gosh, we don't have to drag you through 24 pages then. We'll make it 10. And we would cut. We went through, we had a season in production, and we cut existing 24-page comics in half. We just found a break point. Sometimes we'd go back to the writers and be like, hey, we're releasing this in two parts. The ending doesn't feel quite smooth. Will you revise? Will you add a panel, take away a panel? So having that flexibility means that we can handle the logistics. We can handle the paneling per page and things like that. And I can work with you on art notes and stuff like that. But we need to know that you know this series like the back of your hand before you get in the room. And that's a really interesting challenge.
Melissa, how do you think a question like that, why do we do blank, would have gone at, say, a big five publisher?
It wouldn't have. And I don't say that to fault big publishers. The work they do works for a reason. And I did it for many years. But if we're going so specific, like if we look at why do we do page count the way we do at a big publisher, it's one of my favorite fun facts about publishing. And if you're listening to this podcast, you might already know it. The reason we print books in multiples of 16 is strictly because of how book printers operate and where they fold the pages and where they can cut the pages out. So if you're writing a picture book, oh my gosh, I will yell this into the void. If you're writing a picture book, it's 32 or 40 pages. That's 99% of the time. That's it. Because of how printers operate. For picture books, it's multiples of 8. For novels, it's multiples of 16. It is a machinery issue. At Epic, we didn't have a machinery issue. We do digital books. We can make it whatever we want. Now, I will say we do have print deals with Andrews McMeel, hence the print book. So by the time the print volume comes around, we'd probably have to make some adjustments so that we match the signatures and things like that. There were adherences we'd have to hold to, but the flexibility of publishing exclusively in digital gave us so much runway to do what we wanted, try, iterate, say, ooh, that topic got like no reads, but this topic got 100 billion reads and kids are still searching for it. Let's see what we can come up with. It was such a guidepost for our iteration and that made it really fun. I give a lot of credit to the respect for art. One of my favorite parts about traditional publishing was that question of, it's not can we sell it, but it's how can we sell it? And I loved when that question would get asked because it showed a willingness to take risks within existing parameters. But a lot of times it's not very numbers driven. And to be in a numbers driven environment that was still endlessly creative was such a boost for me.
You know, it's so you're killing me. You're killing me. My business before Manuscript Academy was similar to this, and I never got it off the ground. And I'm like, they're doing it. I knew it. I knew they could do it. And
it's
I think it's real. So, and like, we just didn't have the money. We were like here in Maine. But I think it's like what's interesting is when we're talking about children readers or adult readers, right? We have to always consider literacy. And like, so many kids that aren't good with books are very computer literate. And so the more you, it doesn't matter how anyone reads, does it really matter? And so that's why I think it's so important. So there's people out there listening and they're like, wow, I would love to get into something like this. How does one do that?
Yeah, great question. You know, it's tough because Epic is a bit of a unicorn in the market right now when it comes to opportunities like this, but there are always opportunities for freelancing and learning new sorts of structure in the writing world. And I had to learn comics coming in on sort of a crash schedule. When I got to Epic, I'd had exposure, but I didn't pretend to be an expert. And I don't now. There are people that are listening to this that will know far more than I. But I would say if you're interested in comic style writing, coming only exclusively from Epic, I don't know that I can fully speak to like how a freelancer might approach this, though we can get a little bit into how I would maybe like prefer to see it. But in terms of like, how would you get into like practicing comic script writing? I think one of the biggest resources for me, honestly, was watching a lot of animation. And that was one of the cool things about Epic is finding where the experience translates. And Julie, to your point, we were talking earlier about how anyone can be a reader in any format. Like watching animation, you can write it off as like watching TV, but think about it as storytelling and visual storytelling, artistic storytelling in particular. When a character is talking, what is happening behind them? When a character's face is zoomed in on, why is that? When the camera pans back out, what do you gain? What do you lose? Thinking about those visual cues, and Jessica, I think this came up with you earlier as well. Thinking about visual cues will make you a better writer, and it will be the X factor in writing a script. Read comics for their text, kind of turn off your picture brain, read the speech bubbles, read the sound effects, read the words on the page, then go back and read it as if there were no words on the page and just look at the pictures and see what you get. Turn on that side of your brain that's not words exclusive. It's a really fine balance because you don't want to dictate to your future artist. It must look like this. The colors have to look like this. I'm writing it in 6 panels and this panel can't be dropped. Like, you have your license, of course, but it's like picture book writing. The illustrator's gonna get their say. And the most magical part of script writing is realizing that you're not drawing the book. So the story is going to shine through way more in the art as long as your words set up the guardrails. So take in a lot of visuals. And I think that will really help kind of level you up in the comic space.
Can you talk more about how in picture books, I don't know if you've run into this, but so many picture book writers think they're not allowed to use any illustration notes at all. It's as if one person said, illustration notes are bad, never do it, you're bad, stop thinking about it. Say more.
If you've ever been on a Manuscript Academy consultation with me for a picture book, I probably hung up the call and said, I would love for you to add more art notes. And listen, I think it is individual editor to editor. And so I can only really speak for myself, but I cannot trust your vision of the book if you don't give me hints of it. And again, it's a delicate balance. I don't want you to dictate it to me. I don't want you to say yes, this, no to this. Like, you know, you don't have to say he's wearing a red shirt, blue pants, and yellow shoes. Like, you have to tell me how the scene feels. You have to tell me how the scene feels emotionally and through the eyes of your characters. I really think the more you can tell me, the better. The more I know as your editor, the more I'll be able to match an illustrator that can execute. And I think that synergy is what's really, really important.
I was thinking as you were saying that, is a perhaps possible way of thinking about it, if you gave those instructions to one of those AI image generators, should it be enough to tell it what to do? Or should it be more vibe versus facts?
Ooh, that's so good. Yeah, I've never thought about it like that. I think if I were to put art notes into an AI generator, I would want it to come back a little bit wrong.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
You know, because you want your illustrator to have freedom. You want to be able to look at your story through new eyes when you get first sketches and be like, oh my God, I never imagined it looking like this. I never thought about it like this. And you also want to have it be exactly what was in your head. But it's the emotional truth. You want the emotional truth in your art notes rather than the nitty-gritty.
Going back to thinking about the world visually, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. We could have, for example, one party where all of the facts are the same. The sandwiches look the same. The clothes are the same. Let's just say for the heck of it, we're in the 1920s. We could, if we were the narrator or the point of view of the story, say we are a floating camera and we can follow different things around. We could make it a food story. We could make it a murder mystery. All of the information is there. It's just, how do we focus visually?
Yes, 100%. I love that. It's about, where is the lens pointed? We have a single in-house illustrator who is like carrying our team. And working with him has been such a dream because he is the kind of illustrator where if I get to a point in the text where I've edited within an inch of its life and the writer's revised and we're both just sick of it, and I can be like, all right, there's a battle scene. There's an action scene. It's Cat Ninja. There's going to be a battle scene. And there's me moving around. Chad, you do it. I can just pick it. to the illustrator. And Chad's like, I'm on it. And then he'll like get back to me and be like, I was actually, as I started, I was thinking about this as two panels. You only had it as one. Do you mind if I break it into two? I'm like, no, what? This is your story now. Like being able to have that freedom for him to say, you know what? You and your art notes were pointing the lens at the whole battle, but I want to turn the camera here and then here. That's magical. That's a different movie. Like,
so that's just something for you to think about in your story. Can you draw it? If you can't draw it, and you don't have to be a good, you don't have to show this to anyone, but if you don't know who's in that kitchen or you don't know if there's spilled milk or any of it, then you should not be sending it to anybody.
That is truly one of my most deeply held creative beliefs, which is by the time you are sending your story to a professional, there are two things you have to know. Thing number one is everything about your story. And thing number two is that everything will change. And and both of those have to be true. It's firm convictions loosely held, right? Like the more you know, down to the granular, down to the color of the sunlight on the wall, the more you know, even if you're not saying it explicitly in your text, the more we will know. The more your editor will know, the more your illustrator one day will know. But if you know it so much that you can't accept any other vision of it, then you're dead in the water. It's not going to go anywhere because there has to be that give and take as the creative stages progress. So I really think both have to be true.
I love that. And it's true. If you really, really know what it looks like, you will just happen to choose adjectives that happen to nudge us into that color palette or nudge us into that pattern on the fabric. All of the little things that we all just happen somehow to see similarly.
One of the coolest things about being an editor, I think, is when you end up in the acknowledgments of books. My mom still to this day will go to bookstores and flip through the acknowledgments to see if it's like me or any of my friends. And all of the acknowledgments are incredibly kind, and authors never have to mention their sort of publishing team, and it is a gift when they do. But one of the nicest, most unforgettable acknowledgments I ever got was when an author mentioned me and said to Melissa, who brought me deeper into my story than any of you will ever see.
Wow.
That was so meaningful to me because I remember we would have conversations and I would say, we were talking about her conflict and her villain. And I was like, do you know why this war started 50 years ago that like set this book in motion? And she said, I don't know. And I said, I'm going to need you to know. And she's like, but I'm probably not going to put it in the book. It's going to make it too long. And I was like, no, you're right. Like, I don't want it in the book, but you need to know because that will dictate everything that comes next. And it will change how I edit, and it will change how your story goes.
That's so interesting. It's almost like those DVDs that would have the deleted scenes.
Exactly. Yep.
You need to write your deleted scenes.
Expanded scenes. They're different things. You have your bloopers in one folder, but you can also have your expansion pack.
So Jessica, going back to your original idea, the floating party where there is that amazing lens, right? If it's about food, right? The types of food, this could be really interesting. You could have it on that. And like just the desserts in a contemporary woman's fiction.
Yeah.
The type of desserts these women eat could tell everything. It might be just the shoes. You don't have to kill it. It could be like a couple of just details. Like, right. It's the nano details. It's not going on and on and on. All of these women that you want to talk about, and then one's different. And then you can feel that or whatever, but it's all a conscious choice.
Totally. I think there can be a thin line between the conscious choice of like that and the stereotyping. And it's not just like, these are the kind of women that wear stilettos and the women over there are the ones that wear sneakers. Like,
right.
It's not a party with like, you know, tiny decadent bakery goods is necessarily any better than a party with an ice cream cake pulled from the freezer or whatever, but it's not the details that stereotype, it's the details that matter. Like,
exactly.
You know that one color lipstick that your best friend wears, like, you know that's hers. You know it's not just like the same as Taylor Swift's red lipstick, right? Like, how do you describe that detail in a way that makes it hers and doesn't make it stereotypical? Very fine line. Again, firm convictions loosely held. Like, you can say that you know exactly what it is, and then an illustrator will say, okay, you're saying this, but I'm seeing this. And you have to be willing to go with the flow.
And you have to give them something. You can't just be like, they are in a house.
Right. They are in a fancy house. Like, okay, even that is like one step further. And I'm like, well, got anything else? What kind?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because going again with this party where you can move the camera around, you can focus on different details. You could, in theory, even have one version of this party where there's a thriller if we focus on the knife and this other part where it's a rom-com where we focus on the lipstick. These visual details are a great way to, I'm trying to think of another way of saying show, don't tell, but it's a great way to tip us off to what we should be paying attention to.
And I think it's an important reminder when it comes to comic books and when it comes to picture books and any sort of illustrated art medium. I think you can see it as liberation. It's not like, oh my God, art notes, another thing I have to do. Like, I think it can feel like that, especially when we're getting so specific. It's liberation from making your text do all the work and you still getting to have a say in the vision. Like, I would so much rather see an art note that says, it's a beautiful sunny day, then you start your picture book with, it was a beautiful sunny day when, you know, like, free yourself from that.
So the listeners are like, okay, so there needs to be just enough art notes or just enough details. Can you give us pointers of the just enough?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say when it comes to a picture book, I think this sounds tangential, but it matters. I think it's important when it comes to a picture book and a graphic novel as well to map out your pagination in your manuscript. Changeable. Your editor will mess around with it. You might add stuff that makes it longer. Map out your pagination. Know how that looks. Understand what a spread is. And understand what, if you're doing a graphic novel, understand what panels are. And that way, once you have that understanding, you don't have to do an art note on every single page. You should probably do one on every single panel. If you're writing a graphic novel, that's kind of par for the course. But that also means it can vary. Like, rather than doing an individual page, do it for a spread. If you have an idea in your head where you're like, I'm picturing this just on the left-hand side of the spread and it's three spots of like a bunny hopping across the page, whatever. Like, say that. Say left side of the spread, multiple spots. Like, you can get that specific, but you don't have to. If you're working in spreads and you're working in panels, that will give you sort of the structure you need to lighten up or increase your art notes. If you have no art notes in a picture book, bad, in my opinion. I would be like, what am I supposed to be visualizing here? If every page has an art note that's like four lines long, I'm already tired. Don't do that. Happy medium and really understanding pagination, I think, is going to be a key in making sure your art notes are balanced throughout your submission.
It's interesting because as we're talking about this, I'm wondering if there are any genres that wouldn't benefit from a round of revision where you know your art notes.
I'm telling you, I stand by this. I think my moving from prose into comics, like, I want the art notes for your novel, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because if everyone was thinking of turning their books into movies, have you spent enough money on the set? Have you spent enough money on the costumes? You should be imagining a very high budget for both, even if it's just your novel. Because if we're looking at the same thing the whole time, we get bored fast.
Be your own costume designer. Be your own set designer. That is such a fun way of looking at it. I'm a big fan in the editorial process. And even just like the editorial process that happens before you have an editor, if you're prepping something for submission, if you're like revising your work, of just like breaking the mold. You can't read your novel six times in a row and not want to like jump out a window, right? Like, you have to make it fun for yourself. And I think such a fun way of doing that would be like go chapter by chapter, pick the primary settings and like write the art note. If someone were to draw a movie poster of just that scene, who's in it? What does the setting look like? What are they wearing? Is there background music? Score your novel for all I care. Like, get into the multimedia. And I think, Julie, to your point earlier, like, Epic has really taught me so much about that. Like, I mean, if reading was just words on a page, none of us would be here. We all know it's more than that. So stretch yourself and make it more than that.
I love that. How does a person get to the heart of their story?
Oh, we are running low on time. How much time do we have? That's the question, isn't it? Okay. The way you get to the heart of the story, if we're going to keep this as easy as possible, as actionable as possible, pitch your story. I don't care if it's to another person or if you write, condense your story into like three sentences max. Max. Not semicolon sentences, not M-dash sentences. Like, that crap I would try to pull because I love interruptive punctuation. Don't do it. Three tight sentences. Read those sentences back. And then at each one, ask why. Say, okay, this she's going on a quest to find her long lost husband. Why? Because he's gone. Why? And don't write another pitch, but like start bullet pointing your answers to these questions. Ask yourself why until you cannot anymore. And when you can't anymore, set a timer, 5 minutes, 3 minutes of this. When you can't ask why anymore, look at the last thing you wrote. If it's still about plot, give yourself another 3 minutes and start to shift toward messaging, shift toward theme. Why emotionally are these decisions getting made? If you're already there, great, you're a leg up. That's when you start getting closer to the why behind all the whys of your narrative. That is the heart of the story. That is the reason for being. If you do that exercise and you're like, I got nothing. I came up with like, because the king of a million years ago started a war, whatever. Like if you're still stuck in plot, then I suggest you do a really big reroute and you say, why did I start writing this? What was this to me? What was the message that I wasn't getting in the world, so I had to tell it to myself. Somewhere in the middle of those two things is the heart of your story. And then every sentence that you write or revise or every art note you include is going to have to connect back to that why in a way that is way less than all of the whys that came before.
And another opportunity for why. Let's say you get feedback you don't agree with. Can you just be like, why?
You know what? Yeah, you can. One of my favorite experiences in my editorial career has been, and I've told her this before, so I will name drop if it's okay, with Lily Lanoff in writing the YA novel One for All. Lily identifies as a disabled woman, and she wrote a story with a disabled main character. It was a spin of The Three Musketeers, and her main character was chronically ill. And I would make revisions. I would offer suggestions. And Lily would say, I hear you on why you're bringing that up. Or to your point, she would ask me why I was suggesting it. And I would have to be honest with her, which good, hold your editors to task. And she would say, you know what? I hear you and I agree. I'm going to make that change. Or a couple of times she said, I hear you about why you want to cut that scene. And I actually really disagree. And the reason I disagree is that this scene is in here for a particular reason. And she explained that reason to me. And I remember it well. It was a scene with our main character, Tanya, was in the very early chapters. Her mother was trying to marry her off. And there was this big scene with a suitor that I thought was running a bit long. And I told Lily so. And she said, I hear you, but that exchange between them is really important to her identity as a disabled woman. Because exchanges like this happen all the time and nobody really thinks anything of it until it happens to them or it happens to someone close to them. And that's an important moment for me to set up for later. And I said, heard Jeff, but can we meet in the middle? And that's the trick. When you push back on your editor's feedback, you can't necessarily fairly expect that your editor will just put their hands up and say, okay. Sometimes we do, but what made Lily so powerful at returning feedback and really playing with me in that space was that she would meet in the middle. She would say, I hear you, but these are my reasons. And I felt like she gave me all the freedom in the world and all the trust in the world to say, understood, can we achieve that and achieve what I was saying? Can we keep that dialogue and also tighten it up a little bit? And she said, sure, and came back with what I believe is the scene in the final book. So be willing to push back, but again, firm convictions loosely held is number one.
Okay, so for those out there who have been writing novels, writing text-based only works, what do you think is the best first step to transitioning to writing visual work?
Read a lot of it. If that's not like implied, I'll give a step two, but that has to be step one. The only reason that I could transition to even like the role in comics that I had is because of the amount of comics I took in before it. It is a medium like anything else. I recommend too that you talk to people who do comics specifically, come talk to me. But like I sat down with my editorial colleagues at First Second and said, can you explain to me how the heck a panel works? Why are there so many of them? And they were like, gotcha, here we go, walk it through. Like I was asking the basic questions for graphic novels and you should too. It is not a new medium, it has been around, but there is a new level of sort of rigor and focus around it these days. And there are people who are experts and you should tap them. That is step one. if you're already doing that, and that's how you know you want to get into this medium, then good on you. That's exactly what you should be doing. Step two for doing it is I really do stand by that it comes down to watching visuals and learning the visual element. I think that's the hardest bridge for a lot of writers to gap. If you've written prose work, I trust that you can write dialogue. Like, I'm not worried necessarily about your ability as a scriptwriter, but think about the visual world, and then not just the visual world, but the way the text looks on a page full of visuals. That's one way to really break you of any writer's tendency to overexplain. You don't have the space. Like, look at all the word panels on this page. That's the biggest one. And it's like a sentence, you know, you have to be economical. So when I say think visually, do everything we've been talking about with taking in animation and thinking about screenwriting and setting your own scenes, but also then think about visually where your text will fit on your page and cut, 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 baby, make it shorter.
Love that.
I know there's a screenwriter's Bible. Is there a great book for comic books?
You know what? I am going to Google it so fast. First one that came to mind. It's called Writing Radar by Jack Gantos. That one is just phenomenal. It's so like quirky and the artwork is so fun. And he's such a thoughtful writer. Writing Radar is such a good one for just like storytelling in general. And it's a good way to get you back to basics, because at the heart of it, script writing is a stripped back prose novel. It's just the dialogue and the art notes.
So what is your number one tip for writers?
Number one tip for writers like at all? Oh man, let's see. We've said it in a couple of versions in this podcast already, and it's a way to reiterate it. I think my number one tip for writers has to be simply, it's not that deep. And that is true on so many levels. Like, okay, you can't get that scene exactly right. Not that deep. Write the next one. You've written 500 query letters and it's still not hitting. Not that deep. Go to a conference, get some new ideas. You don't like the illustrator that your editor paired you with. Probably not that deep. They might do a good job. Go look through their portfolio. And if you're still upset about it, you could probably talk to your editor. They'll be more mad if you don't. At the end of the day, if writing's not fun, then it's not creative anymore. Creativity is supposed to be inherently fun. And listen, it's going to feel like work. I think one thing we can all agree on is that the hardest part of writing is writing. Like that's real. But if you are not finding the joy in it, and if it is causing you more stress and harm than it is reminding you of all that is good, you have to remind yourself it's not that deep. It's just words. It's a made up world. We're making stuff up. And that means you can make up new ways of doing it and new ways of being within it. And it is the most serious work there is, I think. And it's also not that deep.
I love that. What a great way to end.
Online, people would be like, oh, I said that one thing. You're just like, just said another query.
Supervise it. Do it again.
Okay. It's okay.
Also, and you know what? I'm going to amend a little bit too, now that you bring that up too. I really think one of my deepest held like writing, but also I think specifically publishing beliefs is that was not your last chance. Whatever it was that you're just like, I blew it. That was the moment. And I absolutely just shot it to the depths. Oh, well, there's another one. The longtime publisher of FSG, she's now the president of Macmillan Children's Books. Jen Besser is wonderful and went on her first day on the job, one of her first days at Macmillan, she brought the assistants out to lunch, which just meant the world to us at the time. This was years ago. And we asked her, like, what's your best advice for working in this field and getting to where you are? And she said, there's enough for everybody. If you're an editor and you pass up on that major acquisition, there'll be another one. If you're a writer and you blew your pitch, pitch it again. If your book didn't hit the list this time, the next one might. You have to bust the scarcity mindset, which my therapist has a time with me. So, you know, it's not easy, but you have to bust the scarcity mindset. There is enough for everybody and there is enough for you.
So happy you said that. You know, we were talking about that floating camera in the party. I wish there was a way I could just kind of have one on my shoulder and let people see that that's how I see things. That's how you see things. That's how people in publishing see things. And writers so rarely get to see the perspective.
We see books getting made all the time. It's so easy for us, I think, on some level to be like, of course more books will get made. Of course there's room for you. If it's just you and your one book, like, I understand why it can feel sometimes like it is that deep and like there isn't enough for everyone. It's really, it is not that deep. And there is enough and there will be enough. There is nothing I believe more firmly than that.
And a lot of the things that stress writers out have a positive flip side too. Like, yes, there's a huge quantity of submissions. Yeah, but there's a huge quantity of people looking at them. And yeah, agents and editors move all the time. Yeah, which is great because there are new people coming in all the time.
Totally, totally. It's life and it's not always easy. And you're going to have to remind yourself of it just on repeat. And just because I'm saying it doesn't mean I always think it's true. Like, I've seen books I passed on with barely blinking an eye go on and become number one bestsellers. I have my books that got away. I have my mistakes. But in life, I'm training myself to believe that there really isn't any such thing as a mistake, that like what's meant for you will find you. And the path you're on is the path you're supposed to be on. And, you know, it's not, I think everything happens for a reason is one of the stupidest things to ever be said. But I think knowing that you can't mess up is not stupid.
I would put one caveat on that. No such thing as a mistake as long as you are authentic to yourself.
That is the biggest mistake you can make. And so many little mistakes can follow that. Yep. Yep. And you'll know when you make that kind of mistake. If it's something you're looking back on, like if it's me looking back on that bestseller being like, I shouldn't have passed. Like, I wasn't the right editor for that book. And I knew it. I knew it when I passed. I was like, God, editing this will make me miserable. It is a fine story, but it will make me upset to spend every day on it. So that was the right call. That was a good mistake. But if I had done not that, if I had said, you know what, I should gun for it. I should, I don't know, cut out the competition somehow. Like, that's an inauthentic error. And we don't make those.
Well, let's say you had, and you were miserable, but somehow it still ended up being a number one bestseller, which it probably wouldn't have if the editor was miserable. Let's say it still somehow had. It could have gotten you promoted to a place where you felt like you were going to be there forever. And then you could have this very moment in parallel universe where you had be asking a why are we doing this question? And publishing would be saying, because we always have.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And I think, you know, that's another one of the great frustrations that I think every writer is going to face and every editor and agent, we've all faced sort of the publishing machine. And I take a lot of heart in knowing that the publishing machine in a lot of ways looks really similar to how it did 30, 40 years ago, sure. But also there are people who were in publishing 30, 40 years ago that don't recognize it now. Like, we have to believe that the arc of publishing tends toward change. We have to. And there are so many people out there making that happen. If you think there's not a place for your work, you can make one. And someone will be there to help you make one. Again, as long as it is authentic. And yeah, that is the most important work in the world. But still have fun with it. You can still have fun with it and believe there's room for you at this hopefully ever longer table.
And I think if you're doing the work in the world you're supposed to do, you'll feel good.
You'll know. You'll know.
Yeah. Well, Melissa, this was such a pleasure. I'm so happy we got to speak with you and learn about how dynamic things can be. Like, it sounds like it's so much fun to work where you work.
It is so fun to be in this line of work. And I am so glad I had the time that I had in traditional publishing and have had this time in the digital space. Publishing's gonna, it looks a lot of different ways. And there's a lot of ways to be a reader and a creative. And I'm really glad I've gotten to see this many sides of it.
So where can we find you online?
You can find me primarily on Twitter for my professional life and also LinkedIn, but like, that's kind of boring. I just lurk on LinkedIn. But for fun stuff, you can find me on Twitter. These days, I am retweeting a lot of Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce content. I'm good for a few book opinions here and there.
And what's your handle?
Melissa_Wharton.
And if you'd like to meet with Melissa, talk about your visual elements, talk about if they are visual enough, or if you just need to add some of those illustration notes, but not a paragraph. We will link in the show notes where they can book a meeting with you. Thank you, Melissa.
We are so glad that you joined us. And as always, we appreciate your feedback. Just head on over to the iTunes store and let us know what you think. It not only helps us make this podcast be the best it can be, but it also affects our ratings within the iTunes platform.
We'd love to hear from you. If you're feeling brave and want to submit your page for our First Pages podcast, you can send it to academy@manuscriptwishlist.com. with First Pages Podcast in the subject line. We'd also just love to hear from you.
And if you'd like to learn more about the Manuscript Academy and everything we have to offer,